Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, the Forum's own George Bagot will revisit several of the last century's best-known dystopian classics, such as 1984, Animal Farm, The Prince, and others, in an attempt to highlight the parallels between those great works of fiction and today's real-life toleration of moderate forms of authoritarianism on the national and global stage. This show is recorded on December 23rd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the Forum Committee. The mission of the Forum is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning's program couldn't be more timely, since we're talking about essentially what's now called fake news and propaganda. But I've known George now for 40 years, met him at this church in the 70s, the mid-70s. And even back then, he was talking about Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist, in 1984. And he has been a student of the art of fake news or propaganda for the last 40 years. So I think he is very well qualified to talk about this very current subject. So, George.
Isn't it wonderful to have that kind of title, you know, to... But war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, and the Clean Air Working Group is and clean coal, and all of these things go together because we're dealing with people that want to use the opposites of what they're intending to do. In fact, we see Trump and his friends blaming others for exactly what they're guilty of. You know, so but history is filled with groups seeking power, often in the form of elite authoritarians coupled with a church. Of late centuries, countries around the world are waking to the fact that Russia and China have an interest in destroying democracy in order to gain a greater control in the world. They've weaponized propaganda to enhance existing tribal divisions and to influence those tribal groups like the NRA. It would appear arming the right wing with assault weapons is a prelude to efforts to encourage a return to a civil war. And as noted in Confederates in the Attic by Tony Horowitz, many on the right believe the Civil War never really ended. They believe we're living in halftime. As Nancy Pelosi recently noted, there's a monstrous endgame in progress, from changing the rules in Wisconsin to voter suppression in North Carolina and Alabama and elsewhere. She noted, if democracy will not work for conservatives, they're willing to abandon democracy. So granted, the midterm results seem to indicate a change to preserve democracy. However, I expect the radical right to force more endgame strategies in defense of their position, and they will surely use techniques of power and manipulation, as I'm going to discuss today. To consider what is meant by dystopia, we need to look at defining what is utopia. And my first novel that I read about utopia was written by Sir Thomas More by that same title, Utopia. And in that book, he told of an account of an explorer named Raphael who had visited an island state that was somewhat of a socialist organization. And yet it was also a subtle criticism of the authoritarian state at the time. Anatole France similarly wrote a book called Penguin Island, which is a satire of a Christian missionary who is blind and decides to set sail and go to the south so he can live his life at the end of life in a warm climate. As soon as he sets off on his raft, the currents take him to the north instead, and he goes to near Antarctica, to the North Pole, and runs into a colony of penguins, who he's blind and he doesn't recognize what he's seeing. So he thinks of them as pagans, and so he, noble pagans. So he decides to baptize them. The Lord consults with his saints and theologians and decides that they've converted these birds to humans, thus giving them a soul. And then the story evolves into the history of Western Europe and the Dark Ages and, to the modern era, including the development of cars and terrorists and an endless cycle of authoritarian control being attacked by those who would challenge the hold on society. My favorite truth to power story is the Ibsen's play, An Enemy of the People. The play begins with Dr. Stockman running around his house practicing the speech he's going to give when he's accepting the award for discovering that the contamination of the local health spa baths is causing the illnesses that he's seeing. He's treating as his patients are getting sick instead of getting any health benefits from this, and he's kind of buffoonery, being somewhat of a buffoon about it, expecting that he's gonna become a hero. He's warned by his brother, the editor of the local paper, that some may not be very interested in his report or pleased by his report. His father-in-law, is the owner of the local tannery, which is the source of the contamination to the local baths, and he's critical of the questioning the results, and he also is saying that people won't be able to see them. You're the only one that can see these microbes in the microscope, and then most people won't really want to see that. And so he said there will be others that won't want to jeopardize the future of the town's assets. Unaffected by these warnings, he is determined to share his results at the town meeting that he has helped arrange, where he finds the agenda has been suddenly changed to exclude his report. And after a heated discourse, he is chased through the streets of the town and returns home to find bricks are being thrown through his windows. He then learns he's been relieved of his duties as a town doctor. He's being evicted from his home. His father-in-law storms into the house and announces he's invested all of the money destined to be the legacy for his daughter and her family into shares of ownership of the local baths at a very low price caused by this problem or the stir. The wife then turns to him and notes that he's torn his new trousers. That seems irrelevant, but the Stockman claims he's going to go ahead and fight this battle. But noting his torn trousers, he says, "I've learned another lesson in this, is that when out fighting for truth and freedom, one should never wear one's best clothes." From this, you know, one should not assume that telling the truth will be met with enthusiasm by those in power. Thus the phrase, kill the messenger of bad news. In fact, those in power have historically used lessons from Machiavelli to silence those who challenge their status. As most know, Machiavelli wrote The Prince in 1532 and Discourses on Livy. They're books about power manipulation and control, supposedly a guide to a young prince who's taking over. In the discourses, Machiavelli gives lessons from history events with lessons for the new leader, and then in the new prince, in the prince, he's telling the prince how he should learn prudence. Yeah. The most referred to chapter in The Prince is chapter 14, which is how the prince should do nothing but prepare for war. In times of war, prepare for war. In times of peace, prepare for peace. Prepare for war instead, excuse me. Machiavelli encouraged the prince to emulate the best qualities of those men he admired and to be a formidable opponent in all actions and always being aware of his surroundings, yet never admitting any weakness. He also asked if it's better to be feared than liked. He defines various types of upstarts and how to handle them. The most difficult upstart to handle would be one who is a member of the community and well-liked by the people, and that the way to get rid of him is to suddenly recognize how important he is to the population, elevate him to a higher status, pull him away from the people, put him in an apartment of high status where he's away from his peers, and then you can assassinate him with no problem. He also discusses the use of mercenaries, and the story there is that you can use mercenaries, but when it's time for them to leave, it's going to be difficult to ask them to leave. He discusses also the use of brutes to inflict punishment rather than be blamed for inflicting punishment on any person in society. Similarly, in a book called Winning Through Intimidation by a guy named Robert Ringer, he encourages the recognition of those who might use intimidation as a Machiavellian ploy. He noted intimidation is often a tool used by those arguing from a weak position. Ringer's book is more about recognizing when people are attempting to intimidate you and the optimal responses to intimidation and manipulation. And for that matter, many who read Machiavelli view his work as a guide to recognize and respond to attempts by authoritarians to control populations. Numerous historians even go further, thinking Machiavelli wrote The Prince as a satire, pointing out failings of powerful leaders whom the prince should not emulate. So considering this foundation, what about dystopian novels? Are they dire warnings, or are they guidebooks for authoritarians? Of course, the most commonly referred dystopian authors are Orwell with 1984, Animal Farm, and many of his essays, Huxley in Brave New World and Brave New World Revisited. Sinclair Lewis, of course, wrote the famous novel It Can't Happen Here in the mid-30s, and about a fascist takeover of America. And Jack London wrote The Iron Heel, which is also a dystopian novel of importance. I would recommend reading that. In researching this, most writers will tell you that, or historians will note that all of these authors were affected or influenced by a Russian writer, Yevgeny Zamyatin, and his novel titled We, a fictional account of one state nation occupied by people without names, but given numbers. D-503 is the star of the book, and people are march in step in uniforms and are relatively uninformed. Regarding Orwell, he feared those who would ban books and those who would deprive us of information or the truth. The truth would be concealed from us and we would become a captive culture. In 1984, he noted people are to be controlled by inflicting pain. On the other hand, Aldous Huxley feared there would be no reason to ban a book. No one will want to read one. He feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egotism. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance, and we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some feel-good drug like Soma or opiates, and blind by issues of morality. People would be controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell thought of our fear will ruin us. Huxley feared that our desire will ruin us. And as Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, Civil libertarians and rationalists fail to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. Aldous Huxley also criticized H.G. Wells and others who thought the New World would be filled with wonders of modern science, noting it would be instead evolve into a negative utopian vision of the future where tools of science would be used to control the population. And this concerts well with the Century of the Self series by BBC and Social Darwinism of Edward Bernays, who thought people are basically stupid and need to be guided by the likes of those described by Ayn Rand. People should be trained to desire conformity and single-color cars or one type of toaster and uniforms so corporations could simplify their supply chain. One can read Orwell's Animal Farm as a history of the Russian Revolution. However, it can also be read as a recipe for controlling the masses through social Darwinism, manipulation of rules. All animals are equal except for some animals are more equal than others. And anticipating the response to lies, the story of Buck the Horse in Animal Farm, he was the one who had the courage to say, "I will work harder." Every time there was a problem, he said, "I will work harder." As Buck's health failed and he was he took a fall, he needed to have some medical attention, and the pigs claimed that the truck from the glue factory that took him away to the hospital was the only way they could get him to get that best care available. But some immediately saw this as a lie. Some were skeptical, but despite reports by the pigs he was improving due to excellent care, they never saw Buck the Horse again. People questioned the reports, but as time went by, they questioned themselves and their fading memory. In 1984, Winston Smith is the primary character in the book and the editor of Errors Made by Big Brother. He's constantly correcting Big Brother's speeches so that if there's any failure or falsity that comes out, he goes through and studies all the media and makes corrections so that it's always going to be that Big Brother is always right. He has a lover named Julia, and they fantasize about rebelling. And they find a rendezvous place where they think they're not being monitored. But the story kind of sort of reaches a crescendo when they're given a book called The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism by Emmanuel Goldstein. And it is defined as totalitarian, leading to those who would rebel. It ensured that they would be captured and trained to desire totalitarianism. The conclusion it is fruitless to rebel against totalitarianism. And that the ending of the book is sort of relevant to that statement. That I'm not sure I'll get the quote quite correct, but it ends like as Winston Smith is being escorted down the long white corridor of the Ministry of Love, the long-awaited-for bullet enters his brain that he's won a victory over himself, and then he suddenly realizes he does really love Big Brother. So of late we see the news media is actually using Orwellian statements about the New Knowledge Institute. Rachel Maddow is referring to certain terms that are coming out of this administration as Orwellian. As I mentioned before, the Clean Air Working Group is a working group of air polluters that were seeking to reach an acceptable level of air pollution that they could live with. There are many examples of from Orwell. Newspeak has a shorthand language like Twitter or Instagram, and doublethink is the ability to maintain two diametrically opposing thoughts in one's mind and believe that both of them are true. So one can read this book as a dire warning or a guide onto how to use language and lie and threats of torture or control and to control the masses. And the Goldstein lesson that he who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. According to Jack London's dystopian novel, The Iron Heel, the oligarchy is the largest monopoly of trusts, or the robber barons. He wrote it with the robber barons in mind, who managed to squeeze out the middle class by bankrupting most small and mid-sized businesses, as well as reducing all farmers to effective serfdom. And if you've been following the agricultural activities we've been talking about, that's exactly what's happened to many of the corn farmers and chicken farmers in the United States. Laborers in essential industries like steel and rail are elevated to given decent wages, housing, and education. Indeed, the tragic turn in the novel is Jack London's core warning to his contemporaries is the treachery of these favored unions which break with the other unions and side with the oligarchy. Further, he says, a military caste is formed, the mercenaries. The mercenaries are officially the army of the U.S., but are in fact the employee of the oligarchs. My friend Sheldon Stahl, the late Sheldon Stahl, and I argued over some of these topics over the years. And some will recall that he was a big fan of George Lakoff and his desire to frame discussion points. On the other hand, I was critical of Lakoff, and this was the source of our little interaction of argument. Lakoff attempts to influence society with metaphors to explain phenomena, thinking that you'll have an interchange based on evidence, which is not the case today. It assumes a rational discussion. He would use framing with opponents like the Clean Air Working Group that I mentioned, and those of Clean Coal. The idea that you could have an evidence-based discussion, but that's just not what we're seeing. These efforts may use Orwellian formats to frame their positions, but they know they are coming from a position of weakness. They don't care what we think. They are focused on the uninformed who really don't care about the topic. Is this an Orwellian or a Machiavellian concept or social Darwinism, I ask? There's a big difference between those attempting to promote their economic position and an all-out liar, con man, organized crime figures who lie to confuse under-informed people. To me, this is a combination of propaganda techniques more in line with social Darwinism. As Gary Kasparov noted, the rationale for propaganda is to exhaust critical thinking and to annihilate truth. So no amount of framing with metaphors will combat the weaponized method of controlling the discussion. In my view, Lakoff's framing is like taking a knife to a gunfight. So my current view of the state of using Orwellian measures to control the population is this. Many politicians and crooks are familiar with the principles defined in The Prince, 1984, Brave New World, and Animal Farm. Some, like Dick Cheney, think they can use the techniques of propaganda to accomplish their goals. They consider these books as Bibles. There are also those like the Mercer family in Cambridge Analytica who have used Orwellian and Machiavellian techniques to separate tribes, weaponize information to inflame and encourage antisocial beliefs in order to remain within their specific tribe. However, as Eric Hoffer noted in The True Believer, fanatics are likely to under-informed people who can flip in an opposite direction fairly quickly. They see their tribe fading into obscurity, they can become easily disillusioned and then scramble to find a new tribe, even if that tribe will not accept the ideas of the previous tribe that they belonged to. I'm also seeing how ineffective these techniques of propaganda have been. Most of our media are calling out lies every other minute. We have a ubiquitous internet and social media that informs us about worldwide issues at hand. And as we saw the death of Khashoggi, the Turkish surveillance caught this murderous attack in a format that was ultimately emailed to the world. I conclude that dystopian novels as Bibles has a limited, using them as Bibles has a limited ability to and permanently affect the future. However, the use of social Darwinism, coupled with lessons of those so-thought Bibles of power and manipulation, has forced a serious civics lesson on the youth of America. They having been critical of baby boomers and our inability to get anything done well in the past, they're now seeing how difficult it is to speak truth to power and to affect change when those in power have little or no interest in the change that you propose. My hope is that the Republicanism is now in the throes of change, that an old white men who have controlled this nation for years are quickly being shown the door. However, we should all be aware that the elephant never sleeps. And I thank you.
Thank you, George. We will now have questions. And remember, the rules are one question until everybody has a chance and no speeches. You can make speeches at our meet when we go to the library afterwards for more discussion. So, George?
Well, before we take your question, I had one announcement. I was asking earlier if there was anybody who had not read 1984, and my friend Renee had said she had not read it, and I had brought a hardback copy of 1984. So I'm going to give that to her at this moment. It's not a real major task or major responsibility there, but I collect them. I go to thrift stores occasionally, and if I see a hardback copy or a copy of 1984, I probably have four or five copies. So, yeah, yes, Jeff.
If you were to look at the historical figures that you have been discussing in your presentation, which, if any or all of them, would have something to say important about the lethargy of the population of America and the world, for that matter, in relation to the distraction of most television, most social media, and particularly the preoccupation with the sporting world?
Well, I think that's obviously the answer to that is Huxley. He was critical of those who thought of the modern world as bringing all these benefits to society. Yet he predicted we would be overwhelmed with information, distracted. You could just send fear wasn't a factor for him. It was a. And I think the answer, quick answer, is Huxley.
George, how would you give us a take on your thinking of how our current technology? I grew up with Star Trek, and the future in technology was going to make the universe a greater place. And I would dispute that, given where we are right now. But how do you think that this fits in with the dystopian thinking?
Again, that's the same thing I said earlier, is that Huxley was critical of H.G. Wells and others who thought there was going to be all this grand benefit from science and the future. And, we're seeing iRobots and intelligence. In fact, the science genetics, all of this stuff has the potential to do harm to a society. It has some great potential to do some good. But, how many of you all have an Echo? Anybody know what an Echo is? All right. An Echo is a device you can buy from Amazon.com that you can put in your home. And they come, they're about this big around, and they come little short ones or little tall ones. And if you want, you want to say, Echo, play a song by Warren Zebaum, it'll play a selection of all his songs. If you say, Alexa, who is the number one moron in the United States? It will tell you. And so, but from an Orwellian standpoint of view, this thing listens to you all the time. And in fact, I irritate my wife and Mr. Hake and his wife, because when we go out to their house, or I will mention to Alexa, do you know how to build a pipe bomb? Or I'm not going to build a pipe bomb today. And all of a sudden it lights up a little bit, you know, but it listens to everything and it has a response. And in fact, if it doesn't know the answer to the question, it'll tell you, I don't know the answer. And so every morning we go in and ask, is Donald Trump still our president? I said, I don't know how to answer that. So, anybody else? So we got.
As everybody knows, we now have all these competing interests using the media, which used to be radio, and then it became television, and now we have the internet, and we have this vast amount of information being blasted out to us at all times. Do you have any advice to how people can figure out what is true, or even get close to what is true in this chaotic situation?
You know, that's a real good question, Craig. Is it at the? You know, I read two papers every morning, and I listen to Rachel Maddow pretty regularly. I used to believe that you needed to listen to everybody. You know, like you need to be aware of Fox News or what they're saying. And CNN, and I tend to believe that it's not necessary anymore. I listen to Rachel Maddow every night, and she kind of condenses the Washington Post and the New York Times stories and the like, and in Washington, you know, for that matter, the Wall Street Journal. You have to listen to it with a somewhat skeptical point of view, but I believe it's becoming more and more difficult to essentially get to the truth of the matter, and then you have to use your own intellect and understanding of history to kind of filter through the barrage of things that we're seeing. And that's the hard part. I think that Huxley was right about that we're to the point where people are not reading books, you know. The majority of the people are not, and we're really dealing with under-informed people. We're dealing with people who believe, for some reason, the double-think concept of having the ability to think of two different diametrically opposite views being both of them true. It's very difficult. I recently had a luncheon with a friend from a mechanic friend from Louisiana that was here, and he's a real Trump person, and there's just no common ground. So I think of myself as fairly well read, but I think of the group that I'm looking at right here are fairly well educated people who are thinking and critically thinking. But this is not a lot of the people, at least a fairly large portion of the people in this country are not those people.
First, before I ask my question, I'm going to ask your moderator to make sure before he closes off the program to let Theo speak about next week. I would like you to talk about social Darwinism, getting back to the academic. You used the phrase several times. Would you talk about it, please?
Hitler was a social Darwin, and his friends were social Darwinists. Tanya Harding, Everybody know who Tonya Harding is? She did an act of social Darwinism by hitting her competitor in the knee with a baseball bat or whatever it was. The social Darwinism is easily defined as winning through and incapacitating your opponent and doing damage to them beforehand. And making it appear like it's natural selection, or so it's not. It's a manipulation of the Darwinism techniques of natural selection. You know, I have a hat at home. It says naturally selected. You know, I wore this at Winfield here a while back, and people looked at it for a second, and they're not sure what that means. Darwinism is essentially what they call the species, I'm losing track of it.
Evolution.
Natural selection and evolution, but social Darwinism is thinking that if you can manipulate evolution and incapacitate your opponent, then you're the higher species. Does that make sense? Is it? That's the best I got for it.
Since this has to be a question, how can I get you to stop molesting my Alexa with your pipe bomb thing? I don't want to be on the watch list.
That's right. Well, you know, my wife asked the same question. I think it's, you want to be proud to be on that list, George. I'm proud to be on that list. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to give you any help there. Yes, ma'am.
We had a lake house in Stockton, so we got to spend some time in a small rural town. And I know that there's such a divide in our country between the attitudes and thoughts of the cities and of the rural areas. And I think that one of the things that influences the thought of the rural areas is that they have a news desert, that they have information from one point of view. The big papers do not like to deliver to small communities because it's a lot of trouble. And I wondered if you had any comments on this, because I see this as something that's really affecting our society.
I think that's a really great question. I was recently in Newark, New Jersey, and as I said, I watch Rachel Maddow every night. Well, the Hilton Hotel I stayed in didn't play MSNBC, which I was a little shocked. But so I got to watch CNN for about 5 minutes and decided that wasn't acceptable. The rural parts, and Newark is not rural America either. We were recently, or a year ago, we were in Colorado, and we were traveling back to Kansas City with our grandkids. So we stopped at this in Hayes, Kansas, to a rest stop there, or a restaurant that we went to. And in that restaurant, the TV was playing RT TV, Russian television. And it's not only that that rural America is absent from the rest of media that urban areas are seeing. They're being attacked. Part of the weaponizing of propaganda. And there was I've forgotten the story, but it was exactly the opposite of what I was thinking we were seeing that was happening around the world. It was a very, very slanted viewpoint, and I could hardly wait to get out of the restaurant. It was so it's worse than just being starved by not having the New York Times or or other newspapers available, and because their TV, and in fact, this is what's happening with the radio. Hate radio is the worst part of this deal, too. I think I don't listen to the radio in my car. I don't know how many of you have radios in your car that you use. Once in a while, you listen to NPR, but for the most part, AM radio is just a bunch of hate radio. And in rural parts of the country, you only get the AM version. You may get public radio. You have to do a selection if you're driving through the United States. You have to constantly change your signal to get to NPR. But the stronger radio stations are out there that are just spouting some crazy person telling you nonsense. So, well, look, anybody else? Have we got Theo, or we got one more?
What suggestions would you make about are helping educate some of our younger persons? When I was a teenager, I remember reading Brave New World and some of the different things like that. And actually, one of the main things I remember is that I kept a dictionary beside me because there were words in it that I didn't know, that I was trying to find out what they meant. But what kind of books and discussion would you suggest that we can use to influence some of the people younger than some of us?
Another good question. I believe that, in fact, I've been somewhat optimistic about the last year or so with the youth in Florida after the shooting there and the visit to Washington, D.C., and the thousands of people that are. But I think the lesson, you know, as I said about their being learning a major civics lesson is causing them to want to seek out information. But I think disillusionment, in fact, as a veteran from Vietnam, I came back. I think the best description of how I felt when I came back from the war was I was disillusioned with America. And I think disillusionment has a powerful lesson for the youth of America. And they're going to seek out this truth. And they're going to find out that it's harder to do what they thought they could easily do. They're smart people. A lot of these kids are real smart. They have infinite access to internet. I was joking about Echo, but if you ask it a serious question from more than what's the temperature outside, it'll tell you. It'll give you information. So, in fact, I think with the they're so attuned to the internet that if they have a question, they can go to the internet and look it up, and they've almost learned to not necessarily take the first assessment as the correct answer either. So, I think there's a lot of information out there, and I think there's a desire to look at it. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe you partially answered my question. I was just going to ask if there's hope and what the forces would be that would make you hopeful that this won't continue to be present.
You know, 3 weeks ago I was full of hope. Two days ago that hope disappeared. And so, you know, the answer to that is it's fluctuating week to week. When you have Mattis resigning for the reasons that he is resigning, in fact, as a peacenik, I never would have thought that I would be in favor of staying in Syria. You know, this is a scattergun type of bit of information. It's hard to say, well, I'm going to have an answer for every question when the sand is shifting from day to day. Every week I go and I think, what other dastardly thing could happen, you know? And this guy really knows how to create some dastardly thing that I never anticipated was going to occur.
There seem to be increasing calls for legislation for the big social media folks to begin to censor. How do you feel about that?
You know... when I started seeing the Russian bot stuff on Facebook. I'm not a Twitter user, so I'm the only thing I'm guilty of is using Facebook. And so my wife is just plugged into Twitter, and she loves it. And so and part of the affair with it is seeing the how crazy it is at times. And so I'm not really pleased by the idea of censoring it, but I think it'd be really great to have some sort of educational format that can tell you that that some things are nonsense. You know, we want to use common sense to understand what reality, and yet the underinformed American is the target audience for that. So if you're an intellectual looking at stuff, you're going to question that. Your critical thinking efforts are going to be successful. But protecting ignorant people from themselves is not exactly, I think, fruitful. I think it's what it does then is simplifies messages and then starves us from seeing the craziness that's out there. I think disillusionment is a really good thing. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I live in a retirement community, and Bishop Spencer Place. And we can't use our landlines because they are just inundated with robocalls. I tell my family to wait for 5 rings, and then I will answer. Now, this is just ridiculous. But they are calls that are trying to sell you something. And I guess they think we're sitting ducks, but I would be all for some kind of regulation on the public phones.
I couldn't agree more. My wife has bought a device that, and my wife is a real technical person more than I am. Vicky has a device that you all you have to do is push #2, and it suddenly blocks that caller. And we've blocked maybe 1,000 people, I think. So, and what they do, they have not only have they got robocalls, but they have a robo number. They can just use the next number down the line, and thousands of numbers that they have access to. And so it's you really have to keep blocking them. I don't think there's any hope in the landline effort. I think it's going to be the cell phone, but they're going to do the cell phone too at some point. They're going to play the same. And my worst concerns are these guys that call you. I'm from Windows Technology Group, and we found that you have a problem with your computer, and that we want you to give us your credit card, and we'll fix it. You know. So.
What happened to the do not call list?
I am not an expert on that topic. So, yeah, as I think you're. What's the enforcement agency going to control that? Is what I had asked you, and so there's no enforcement. And as she's saying, I think Huxley. I go back to Huxley. Huxley figured that technology would be ultimately used against our best interests, and that's essentially where we are. And I don't think it's going to change. So, look, Theo wants to say something.
Theo is going to talk about our program next week.
Wasn't George fantastic? I mean, really. Really. I'm sure we're all really glad we made it this morning. Anyway, and relative to the quest for truth, today at 2:00 over at UMKC, 2 months ago, Michael Moore released a film, Fahrenheit 11/9, and it's going to be shown. That's going to be also eye-opening, and I think we can kind of trust Michael Moore. And when you were saying, you know, what do we look for?
So thanks a lot for coming to the forum.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Orwell's Vision of Dystopia, The Jury's Still Out, with George Bagot. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 26th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.